This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL Urbana. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Imagine you have survived the Holocaust. You've emigrated to the U.S. and bought a home in a middle-class suburb of Chicago. Then along comes a neo-Nazi and his followers, promising, "We're coming to get you again." Such was the situation in the late 1970s in Skokie. And the neo-Nazi plan to march down Skokie's main street is a turning point for Robert Rand's first novel, My Suburban Shtetl, a novel about life in a 20th century Jewish American village. The novel looks back at the 60s and 70s. We see Skokie and its residents through the eyes of a young boy, Bobby Bakalchuk. Bobby is growing up in an immigrant community that is struggling with the past and present. What is right? What is safe? WW2, World War II, is over, but the Cold War hangs in the air, and the civil rights movement is in full swing. Robert Rand is our guest this afternoon. He's a journalist, editor, and radio producer. He produced a documentary on the real-life Skokie incident for WBEZ in Chicago, and in this broadcast, we'll hear some clips from that program. Robert Rand was a senior editor at NPR for 8 years. He continues, from time to time, to work in public radio. You may recall the series of NPR reports filed from towns between St. Petersburg and Moscow last summer. Rand worked with Ann Garrels to produce that series, A Russian Journey. Rand is currently living with his wife, a UN diplomat, in Tashkent, Uzbekistan. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments for our guest, Robert Rand, this afternoon. Here are the telephone numbers. In Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call us toll-free, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Robert, good afternoon. Welcome.
Hi, Celeste. Thanks
Hi.
A lot. Nice to be here.
There's so many things we can talk about this afternoon. The novel, growing up in Skokie, the current climate regarding civil rights, life in Uzbekistan.
We can talk about my jet lag from Uzbekistan as well.
and your work as a journalist. When did you get back to the U.S.?
Just a couple of days ago. It was a long commute.
Yeah. How long does it take to travel from there to here?
To Chicago, it took about 24 hours, I'd say.
Things go smoothly?
Yeah, I stopped off briefly in Washington and got a little bit of rest and then headed over here.
How long have you lived in Uzbekistan?
I've been there for almost 5 months now. We arrived before the events of September 11th and, for better or worse, experienced the terrorist acts from the perspective of an American living on what turned out to be a frontline state. It's a sad irony that when we moved there, most people never heard of Uzbekistan, certainly didn't know much about it. And after September 11th, things have really changed. It's a really interesting place to be right now.
Yeah. Now, Tashkent is in the northeastern corner of Uzbekistan. That's quite a bit of ways away from the border with Afghanistan, where there are now U.S. troops and where there's a relief mission being launched. So is life in Tashkent, how is it, what is it like? And what is life like in the rest of the country at this point?
I think about that a lot. In the immediate aftermath of the terrorist acts in the United States, we saw it there. We get CNN and the BBC. And it was extraordinarily difficult for me, as for all Americans, I suppose, to go through. My problem was I was isolated. There aren't very many Americans there. And I didn't really have much of an opportunity to process it, to talk about it. And for days and days and days, it was just sort of internalizing inside me. And at one point, I literally broke down and cried. I lived in New York prior to moving to Tashkent for 5 years, and prior to that, I'd lived in Washington, so these were two cities that I knew and cared about and had friends in both of them. And thankfully, everybody's okay. I think the most telling moment for me in Tashkent was, I think, 3 days after the attack on the World Trade Center and on the Pentagon, and I was just feeling depressed and angry, kind of pacing around my living room. I have a 2.5-year-old son who obviously doesn't understand anything that he saw on TV. And I was kind of sitting on the floor wondering about what was going on, and my son was in a playful mood, and he jumped on my back. And I reacted. I was very angry and kind of got up and stormed out of the room and told him, I can't take another assault. And my wife was watching the whole thing, and she later told me that my son turned around, looked at her with a shocked expression, a stunned expression on his face, and said to her, why? And that was the first time in his young life that he had used the word why. And to me, that really brought home what was going on there. In terms of life in Tashkent, we were really, as everybody was in the United States and all Americans, extraordinarily anxious, particularly because as an American in that part of the world, you can be a target. My wife, who is not an American, she's Japanese, is a UN diplomat, so there was concern about the UN being targeted. Our life was affected in a number of ways. We have a guard now guarding our house overnight. We have visas to Kazakhstan, in case, which is the country bordering Uzbekistan on the north, in case we need to evacuate. We can do that quickly. The Uzbek people were just wonderfully sympathetic. There's a lovely gesture in Uzbekistan where either in a greeting, if somebody greets you or they say goodbye or they want to say something meaningful or emotional to you, they take their right hand and they place it over their heart, and they sort of give you a little bow. It's a heartfelt gesture, and our neighbors who are Uzbeks did that to us, to me, for days afterwards, and it was really touching. The American Embassy in Tashkent, the ambassador there, had held a number of meetings in the weeks after the event with Americans living in Uzbekistan, outlining various scenarios, and the concern was that there would need to be some sort of evacuation. Uzbekistan has had its own experience with terrorism. A couple of years ago, on February 19th, 1999, the capital, Tashkent, was rocked by a series of car bombs, which was a terrorist group called the Islamic Movement of Uzbekistan, which President Bush has said is aligned with Al-Qaeda, was blamed for that event. And there was concern after September 11th, particularly with Uzbekistan and the United States cooperating now militarily, that the IMU, or this terrorist group, would retaliate either against the Uzbek government or against Americans or other Western interests in Uzbekistan. So we were concerned. But I have to say that as time went on and as nothing happened, that level of anxiety has decreased. Uzbekistan, as you probably know, and your listeners may or may not, is one of the former 15 Soviet republics. Its president, Islam Karimov, is the former Communist Party boss. Uzbekistan is an authoritarian state. There's a very large police presence. And to be honest, the mood among Uzbeks now, this was true even before September 11th, but especially afterwards, is that maybe that's not such a bad thing because people feel pretty secure. And so do we. Our anxiety level is down, and hopefully things will be okay there. I joke facetiously with some of my American friends living here when they say, you know, are you safe? You know, you're living right on a country bordering Afghanistan. I say, arguably, it's safer in Tashkent than it is in New York or Washington. You know, we had no anthrax scare in Uzbekistan, for instance. I don't know whether that's a fair assessment or not, but maybe there's something to that.
Yeah. Well, I know that. Let me ask you this question. The Islamic movement of Uzbekistan, how much sympathy in the country for that movement among Uzbeks?
Uzbekistan's 90% of the country, 90% of the population is Muslim. But it's a unique, maybe not unique in the world, but unique in my experience. I call Uzbekistan a secular Islamic state because the government is, while promoting and allowing the practice of Islam to a certain degree, the government is a secular government. It has tolerance and for normal, run-of-the-mill, everyday Muslims, but it has no patience or tolerance for fundamentalist Muslims who, particularly those who preach the overthrow of the state. I'm not sure I've been there long enough to gauge. I know that in a certain part of the country called the Fergana Valley, which is the home to a larger number of more fundamentalist-leaning Muslims, that there is some sympathy there for the Islamic movement of Uzbekistan. On the other hand, there have been very, very few reports of any anti-American or anti-Western protests in the country after September 11th and after the United States opened or received permission to use an air base in the southern part of the country. So there may be some latent support for the IMU, the fundamentalist group, but my hunch is, and certainly this has been my experience in Tashkent talking with Muslims there, the overwhelming majority, I think, is supportive of the government, of Karimov's government, and of the United States' effort to eradicate terrorism. It was Uzbekistan that the Soviet Union used as the base of operations in their failed war in Afghanistan. And I have to tell you that the Uzbeks lost people in Afghanistan and have no great sympathy for the Afghan people, particularly for the Afghan terrorists.
Mm. The Uzbeks fought with the Russians, and there are quite a number of Uzbeks living in northern Afghanistan, right?
That's right. I don't know the percentage, but a large percentage of the Northern Alliance is made up of Uzbeks. General Dostum, who was the general who engineered the capture of Mazar-i-Sharif a few weeks ago, the city in the northern part of Afghanistan, which had been a stronghold of the Taliban. General Dostum is an ethnic Uzbek as well.
Now, as you mentioned, organized political opposition isn't tolerated, and there are no independent media. What is the situation with this man that had to flee, the opposition leader, Mohammed Salik, who is now, I guess, in Prague?
I don't know.
Yeah, okay.
I can't answer.
Yeah. It'll be interesting to watch this situation as well, because he's apparently under arrest there on an international warrant, and it'll be interesting to watch. Also, we should note that Amnesty International has cited Uzbekistan for all kinds of political oppression.
They're not the only ones. If you read the State Department's annual human rights reports, the chapter on Uzbekistan, it's pretty depressing reading. I think the thing that surprised me most about living there is in getting to know and talking with Uzbek citizens who are both ethnically Uzbek, and many of them are Russians. Some are Tatars. There are many Koreans even living there. What surprised me was the extent to which they support the Karimov government. They've been able to find a certain degree of personal freedom. They can pretty much do what they want as long as they don't criticize the government. I mean, there's no free press, as you pointed out. If they're Muslims, they can pretty much practice their religion as long as they don't do anything that resembles fundamentalism. But the fact of the matter is that the number of people who want to be extremely devout Islams who would go beyond the constricts of what the state allows, or the number of people who are human rights activists who really want to try to fight the system and try to bring about a free press, who want to try to promote political diversity in Uzbekistan, that's a very, very small number of people, and I don't at all mean to diminish what they're trying to do, because those are very important principles. Those are the principles of free speech, for instance, that was the issue at the heart of the Skokie controversy that I deal with in my novel. But the average guy on the street in Tashkent, anyways, isn't concerned about those human rights issues, and he's relatively satisfied with his life. And I think from the perspective of the average person in Tashkent, the biggest issue is the economy. Uzbekistan's a very poor country. The average monthly income is something like $20 a month. So people are hurting, and that's what they think about more than political rights.
Your novel seems just to be just right for the moment. As I mentioned in the introduction, I think it is. It asks, you know, these questions, and it forces us to look at ourselves when we ask, you know, what is right, and how do we keep ourselves safe, and how do we walk that line?
There's a principle of Judaism, one of the fundamentals of it, I suppose you could say. In Hebrew, it's the word that's called chesed, which means compassion. And what it means is, it's the golden rule. It means that you should treat others as you would want them to treat you. And the novel, My Suburban Shtetl, deals with the notion of compassion, and particularly with the flip side of it, which is intolerance. And what interested me, both in my own experience growing up in Skokie, which I did in the 1960s, and in the experience of Bobby Bacalchuk, who is clearly my alter ego in the novel, is to explore the different layers of intolerance that people experience. Somebody once wrote that the wall of color makes even decent men waver. Skokie was filled with, and is filled with, decent people. And the characters that surround Bobby Bacalchuk in the novel are decent people. But when they face some of the forces that contemporary America throws at them, when they face people who are not like themselves, it's interesting to try to understand how they react, and even decent people can react with various levels of intolerance. So there are different layers of intolerance that I describe in the novel through the narration. The main thing, of course, the stage upon which the novel takes place was the controversy that you mentioned in your introduction in 1977 and 1978, when the American Nazi Party wanted to stage a march in Skokie. At the time, had a very large Jewish population, not a majority, but something like 40% of the village was Jewish, which is an extraordinarily large amount for any American town. And also some 7,000 Holocaust survivors lived in Skokie, and you know that's the reason that the American Nazi Party wanted to march there. And they did it by waiving the First Amendment. So there's the issue of how do you react to the First Amendment? How do you react to Nazis who want to bring a swastika into your community? Do you react with tolerance and understanding, or do you react with intolerance? That's one level. There are other levels as well. I mean, how do Jews relate to non-Jews? How do Jews relate to African Americans and the integration of their village? How do school kids react to Norman Meyer Ashkenaz, one of the characters in the book, one of my favorite characters, mm-hmm. who is the, Norman Meyer is the odd-looking cootie, as I call him, in junior high school, or grammar school, who is heavy and he sweats a lot in gym class and he looks like a human rumple. Do kids react with chesed? Do they react with compassion to somebody like that? And what impact does that have on a child once he grows up? So those are the issues. Those are the decisions, as you phrased it, the issue of compassion and intolerance. Those are the subtext. Those are the themes that I wanted to try to deal with in spinning out the tale in the novel.
Yeah. I haven't thought about cooties for a long time.
Oh, did you hear the expression yourself?
Oh, yeah.
Did you have a cootie shot when you were young?
Yes, we did. Okay, or a cootie spray.
Okay, there you go.
But we never had an individual we called a cootie.
Well, you were more compassionate than the circle of people I grew up in then, I guess.
Mm. There's a hilarious and touching chapter in the book about kids sorting out their religious differences. The title of the chapter is Gentiles. Maybe you would tell us about this chapter. Tell us about Bobby and Susie and the abduction of Jesus.
Yeah. somebody asked me the other day what I recalled most about the Hanukkah season. Hanukkah begins, I think, Sunday night, right? When I was growing up in Skokie, and my answer was Christmas, basically, because I went to a place called East Prairie Grammar in junior high, and every time December came around, this time of year, we would have the annual Christmas pageant, and all these Jewish kids, myself included, and Bobby Bacalchuk in the novel, participated in the pageantry and learned these lovely, wonderful Christmas songs, God Rest Ye Merry Gentlemen and Silent Night, and so forth. And it was reflective of, you know, the multi-ethnic, multi-religious society in which we grew up in and in which Bobby Bacalchuk grew up in. His neighbor was not Jewish. The family that lived next door to Bobby Bacalchuk were the Andersons. And Susie Louise Anderson, the young 9-year-old girl, and Bobby was 9 at the time as well, was Bobby's first love. And she was a dish. She had blue eyes and flowing blonde hair and looked unlike anybody else in Bobby's tribe, so to speak. The family was different. They were a family of with roots in Wisconsin, a farm family, and they even had farm animals in their backyard for a time in Skokie. And Bobby would go over there and ride on a horse named Buster, and it was just the most exotic thing a Jewish kid in a suburban shtetl could ever do. And I use that relationship as kind of a touchstone to examine issues of Jewish relations with non-Jews. And the storyline, as it's played out, is it's Christmas time. And as was the case in many communities across the United States, an issue arose over whether the local governmental authority could sponsor a Christmas display, a Christmas creche, which is the manger scene with the baby Christ and the wise men and so forth. Everyone's familiar with that. Whether the sponsoring of such a display was constitutional, and the First Amendment of the Constitution not only prohibits infringements on freedom of speech and of the press, but also calls for the separation of state and religion. So in the chapter, one evening or one morning, the village wakes up to find that someone has stolen the baby Christ from the manger scene on the village green. And Susie Louise Anderson, Bobby Bacalchuk's Christian friend, was bereft because someone had stolen the baby Jesus. And she asks Bobby, "Did you kill Jesus?" And Bobby, who is in love with Susie Louise, starts trying to understand what's going on. At one level, he knows he's absolutely clueless about Jesus Christ, as most Jewish kids are when they're that young, and maybe as most Jewish adults are even now. And it's, you know, it's confusing. Bobby says, you know, Bobby goes to his friend Norman Meyer Ashkenaz for counsel because Norman Meyer's the smartest kid around. And Norman Meyer tells him that Jesus was Jewish, which throws Bobby even further into confusion, because if Jesus was Jewish, why do Jews object to him, and why might a Jew have stolen the baby Christ? So Bobby, in an effort to make Susie Louise happy again, because it is the Christmas season, organizes a posse of Jewish kids in search of Jesus, the baby Jesus, the missing baby Jesus. So they go traipsing around the community, knocking on doors, trying to gather information, hoping that they can find the allegedly Jewish person who stole the baby Christ. They fail miserably in that pursuit, but in the pursuit, they get different reactions to the whole concept of a Jewish group of kids trying to help out a bunch of Christians. Some of the community reacts with intolerance, saying, you know, how could a Jew try to do something to support Christianity? How could a Jew go out in search of Jesus Christ? kind of a variation on Jews for Jesus, I suppose, it occurs to me now. While others in the community react with some compassion and understanding that this is an important symbol for the Christian community, and it's not the right thing to do to steal the baby Jesus.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, they fail, and there's one of my favorite scenes in the book. It's Christmas Eve, and Susie Louise Anderson is very upset because the baby Jesus is missing, and so much so that she doesn't go to Christmas Eve Mass. She sits home alone, and Bobby, in an effort to console her, walks in front of her house carrying a single lit candle in the dead of night. Susie peers out of her window with some tears in her eyes and looks at Bobby standing there singing Silent Night, Silent Night.
Mm-hmm.
This is a little Jewish kid in my suburban shtetl.
Yeah. The stories in the book, the chapters in the book, they could stand on their own, I think, almost. And I was reminded of Gene Shepherd when I was reading the book as well, the way you tell the stories. Back to the centerpiece of the book, the Skokie incident and this character Frank Collin. I barely remember this, even though I was of an age where I should have remember this. Were you living in Skokie when Frank Collin appeared on the scene?
No, I was living in Germany, ironically.
Oh, like
Bobby Bacalchuk.
Grown up Bobby.
That's right. Yeah, and I followed it from the perspective of somebody living in Munich, where the local press back then in 1977 and 78 gave it a lot of coverage, understandably so. It was their Nazis, in other words, referring to the United States, that the press was interested in. So no, I wasn't living in Skokie.
Mm. Had Frank Collin's father truly survived the concentration camps?
In my research for the book, that is what I discovered. Other researchers had reported that, yeah.
What's the story of the Collin family?
You know, something beyond that, I don't know much. I know that, I know what's become of Frank Collin, and I reported that in the documentary that you referred to that I did for WBEZ. He's changed his name, and he's moved to Wisconsin, where he writes for some sort of a mystical, at least a couple years ago, he wrote for some sort of a mystical internet site. When I tried to reach him to request an interview for the documentary, he very politely said, thanks, but no thanks, I don't talk about that.
Hmm. While you worked on the documentary on the Skokie incident for WBEZ, what were your thoughts about the people who were there who had survived the Holocaust and then had to endure Frank Collin? You grew up there. You're Jewish. And here you were acting, you know, you're a journalist as well. And I'm wondering what was it like for you to be in that situation?
Yeah. You know, when my recollection of 1977 and 1978, when the actual controversy was going on, my feeling about it, I mean, it was a huge deal in this country and even internationally. I mean, the case was a First Amendment case, and to remind your listeners, Frank Collin was represented by the American Civil Liberties Union by a Jewish lawyer, and the case was in litigation for a full year and went to the United States Supreme Court a couple of times, and was ultimately the Supreme Court which finally resolved the Skokie case. The ACLU, it was a disaster for the ACLU in that thousands and thousands of its members resigned and in protest over their decision to handle the case, and they lost a lot of money. My recollection back then was, in terms of reacting to the events and to the impact that it had on the village of Skokie, particularly the Holocaust survivors, was I was pretty much behind the First Amendment. It seemed to me that you don't mess with the First Amendment even under circumstances like that. I believed that, you know, if you disagree with what somebody says, you can just simply choose not to pay attention to it. It seemed to me that maybe the best response back then would have been to let Frank Cowan stage his protest by the village hall, and the people of Skokie could simply have chosen not to show up. You know, if you're standing in the middle of a forest and you shout as loud, and if you rant and rave and shout and scream, if you're in the middle of a forest, nobody's going to hear you.
Mm-hmm.
Similarly, if the village of Skokie, if the citizens of Skokie had decided not to show up, that protest by Frank Cowan would have been pretty empty. But to be honest with you, 20 years later, at a different stage in my own life, I'd become middle-aged and hopefully wiser, more conservative, I think, and, a parent. It wasn't at all as clear-cut as I was interviewing these survivors, both for the documentary and also I interviewed quite a few of them to prepare to write the novel. And I found myself thinking, you know what, as great as the First Amendment is, this is a real tough thing. It's a tough one, and my experience in life has been that nothing really is black and white. Everything are different. Everything is different. It's a different shade of gray, and the clarity that I saw the issue with through younger eyes in 1977 and 1978 didn't exist a few years ago when I was, or last year as well, when I was doing the work on both the novel and on the documentary. There was far more sympathy toward the point of view of the Holocaust survivors.
I thought we would listen to two voices from the documentary. The first voice that we'll hear here is not identified. The second belongs to Felicia Brenner. And this is from Regarding Skokie, Hate and Free Speech, which, by the way, listeners can hear on the WBEZ website if they look up Chicago Matters.
I want you to know that we survivors live two lives. We live today's life, but at no time have we parted from what happened in those years. And to relive it again, the pains, the wounds were not healed. They'll never heal by us. But to make us face it again, we just couldn't accept it. And we were prepared to object to it to the end. The shooting up in the north side of Skokie, that was an act which is obviously hatred, and it's obviously the people who don't care for the law. And the law should be to protect the innocent bystanders. I was strongly advocating that this should not be washed off, that secretion should stay on. It should be a dual reminder what the Nazis did in the 40s and what people are still capable that they have not learned, and there's still hatreds among the people.
My name is Felicia Brenner. I was born in Lodz, Poland. I am a survivor of the Holocaust, a very sad survivor. I wrote a very little poem about the coming of the year 2000. You want me to say it?
Yes.
With amazement I was reading. Some people were going to commit suicide. Some were going to run away. Year 2000, the end of the world is coming. The millennium. Haven't you heard or care? The end of the world already happened. In a town called Auschwitz, the earth was splitting. The gas chambers were working overtime. Haven't you heard the cries of the innocent? The end of the world already happened. It happened to me August 7, 1944, when both my parents were pushed into the gas chambers of Auschwitz. Don't run, care what happens around you. it's killing. And of course, this should not happen. You can hate and you can love. This is up to you. But when you bring it out in the open and it's allowed, and you can say, my constitution permits me to express myself, this is wrong.
Two voices from the documentary regarding Skokie, Hate and Free Speech, the documentary produced by our guest this afternoon, Robert Rand, who is also the author of the new novel, My Suburban Shtetl. Powerful, powerful voices.
Yeah. Let me talk about the first. I can tell you a little bit about both of those people. I should set up the tape that we heard from the man. The man whom in the documentary I called Jacob agreed to be interviewed only on the condition of anonymity, because even 20 years after the controversy with the Nazis in Skokie, Jacob was still afraid that if his name was broadcast, he might receive threats, as he did 20 years earlier, which I found to be awfully interesting. In the first cut, he was recalling his reaction to the threatened Nazi march and the palpable sense that if the Nazis were allowed to march in Skokie, that it would be akin to reliving the Holocaust. And the second cut, he was referring to a murder in Skokie. That was events which your listeners may recall fairly recently. In July 1999, a white supremacist went on a rampage in northern Illinois, in Chicago, and Skokie. He was ultimately captured and killed in Indiana. And
he was here, too.
That's right. You're right. He was captured around Champaign.
Yeah, and he had been a student here at the University of Illinois.
Ricky Birdsong was an African-American and Skokie resident, former Northwestern University basketball coach, who was murdered during the shooting spree. And the murder by a white supremacist in Skokie triggered all kinds of memories, as you can imagine, for the Holocaust survivors living there. And that's what Jacob was referring to in the second cut. And the third cut, where he said that he was an advocate of not removing something. What he was referring to was the following. About 10 years after the Skokie controversy ended, and it ended with the Nazi case, the ACLU represented case, winning the Supreme Court, upheld a federal court decision giving the Nazi Party the right to march in Skokie, although ultimately they decided not to. They did it instead in Chicago, mostly because I believe Frank Cohen, the Nazi Party leader, was afraid that he might get killed. At least that's what the lawyers involved in the case tell me. 10 years after that all ended, at the urging and work of the Holocaust community and survivor community in Skokie, Skokie erected a Holocaust monument, a lovely monument located on the village green between Village Hall and the Skokie Public Library. And on the night of its unveiling, it was desecrated with swastikas. And what Jacob was referring to was he was one of the voices saying that the swastikas should have been left on the monument is a reminder of what hate and hate speech can do to a community. Ultimately, I think after a couple of days, the swastikas were removed, and if people go to the monument now, they'll see it as was intended to look. The second voice, the woman Felicia Brenner, is an amazing woman who been a long-time Skokie resident. It turned out, and I didn't realize this until I interviewed her, that she's the mother of one of my high school friends. I didn't know in high school that my friend's mother was a Holocaust survivor. I had to find out 30-some years later. But you can hear in that poem that Felicia Brenner read the emotion still, more than 50 years after the terrible, terrible ordeal that she went through. she said herself that life ended, and it clearly stays with her for totally understandable reasons that nobody, I think, who didn't go through it could understand. Just as it stays with Jacob, reflected by his refusal to be interviewed on the record because of his anxiety and concern still.
Hmm. You know, as you mentioned, in the last couple of years, we've had some experience with someone like Frank Holland. And within the last year, he's come to town twice. And the first time there was a rather large counter demonstration, and he came back in the fall, and just a couple of people showed up. And you know, you wonder, you know, what is the right response?
This was in Champaign.
Yeah.
About?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think probably the right response was the second response. Just choose to not show up. That option was one of the rationale that the Federal Circuit Court of Appeals in Illinois used back in 1978 when they upheld the right of Frank Holland to demonstrate in Skokie. The court back then said, and this decision was upheld by the Supreme Court of the United States, that what Frank Holland wanted to do, you know, to come into a public place in Skokie and demonstrate was a pristine exercise of free speech that was analogous in Supreme Court litigation in terms of precedent to the cases that came out of the civil rights era when blacks living in Alabama and other southern states wanted to stage public protests. There was a case called Shuttlesworth versus Birmingham from the mid-1960s, I think, when a reverend named Shuttlesworth, a black reverend, wanted to organize a march in Birmingham, and the village, the city of Birmingham, passed some ordinances to try to prevent that, and the Supreme Court held, you can't do that. And it was very analogous to what happened in Skokie. Stephen Klein, who is the character in the novel, who is the ACLU attorney.
With the ulcer.
With the ulcer, right. Relied on the Birmingham case in kind of coming up with his own legal defense of Frank Holland to try to preserve the First Amendment. And in the mind of Stephen Klein, he was not the Nazis' lawyer. He was the lawyer fighting to defend the First Amendment. And, of course, he was Jewish, too, which made it very difficult. He had a very complicated relationship with the Jews of Skokie, who could not, for the life of them, understand how on earth a Jewish lawyer could represent a Nazi. Abe Yellen, the grandfather, who's the main character in the novel, Bobby Bacalchuk's grandfather, cites the Talmud, the body of Jewish law, at one point in the novel, referring to a Talmudic saying that says, you shall not feed propaganda to the enemy. And in Abe Yellen's mind and in the minds of the other Holocaust survivors, that's what the ACLU was doing by defending Frank Holland, feeding propaganda to the enemy. And it was heresy. It was treacherous. And it was something that they just couldn't understand. And it made Stephen Klein's ulcer burn extraordinarily bright at times during the year that he was working on the First Amendment case.
Mm. Skokie is more diverse today than it was in the 60s. I wonder what it's like to grow up there today.
It was really interesting when I was working on the WBEZ documentary to come back to my hometown and to come back as a reporter and producer and speak with people and get a sense of how it has changed. Skokie still retains, to a certain degree, its Jewish identity. There are many Jews still living in Skokie, many young Orthodox Jewish families living here. I checked in the Yellow Pages recently, and there were 13 synagogues listed here in Skokie. I'm speaking to you from Skokie now, so I'm saying here in Skokie.
Mm-hmm.
Yet the village has a diversity that it didn't have when Bobby Bacalchik was growing up there, when I was growing up there in the 1960s and 1970s. 50%, 50% of the high school students in the two Niles Township high schools here, which are the two high schools, have as a native language some language other than English. Immigrants have come here from South Asia, from India, from Pakistan, from Vietnam, in addition to Russia and other East European countries. Between, if my memory serves correctly, between 1990 and 1995, or 1991 and 1995, Skokie received and settled more refugees than any other community in the greater Chicago area, which is a stunning figure. When I was growing up in Skokie, and when Bobby Bacalchik was growing up in Skokie, the main commercial strip was a street called Oakton Street. And there was a Jewish bakery there called the Oakton Street Bakery, which in the novel is sort of a hangout for beatnik-era types. And the owner of the bakery was an activist who organized a harebrained scheme in the middle of the Cuban Missile Crisis. And I'll leave it to your listeners to read it. The chapter is called The Cold War, and it's my favorite chapter in the book.
Yeah.
But I went back to that Oakton Bakery a year or so ago. It doesn't exist anymore, but down the block, one block away, there is a new Oakton Bakery, also called the Oakton Bakery. And I walked in, and there was Arabic music being played. Mm. And I interviewed the owner, and it's run by a woman who was born in Iraq. She's a Christian, and she serves Middle Eastern delicacies.
Mm-hmm.
And that, to me, represented in a very vivid way the change that Skokie has undergone in the last 20 years.
We're out of time, Robert. I want to thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks, Celeste. I appreciate the opportunity.
Robert Rand has been our guest this afternoon. Look for his book, My Suburban Shtetl, a novel about life in a 20th century Jewish American village. It's published by Syracuse University Press.